This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey! Are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right.
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Nuala McGovern, and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Hello, and welcome to Woman's Hour and to Listener Week. This week is all about you and what you want to hear, and we do have some great discussions and interviews coming up all throughout the week. But I am wondering this morning, how are you feeling? In London, it's a little grey outside, perhaps reflecting the mood a little on the Lionesses not winning the World Cup. But even if the fairy tale, as England manager Serena Wiegmann described reaching the Women's World Cup final, didn't have that ending that we wanted, there is so much to celebrate. Making history, inspiring women and girls, changing the narrative, not only for women's football, but also for women's sports. So we've all been on this amazing journey with the Lionesses together. And even if you don't support England, we have been following them and following their rip-roaring successes. So today, the day after they played in the World Cup final for the first time, what do the Lionesses mean to you? You can text the programme. The number is 84844. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through our website. For WhatsApp messages or voice notes, that number is 03700 100 444. You are also going to hear what they mean to Sue Wyatt, one of the 1972 England team, whose achievements then helped lead to the successes of the Lionesses now, and Joe Clark from Baller FC, the women's football collective, who've been organising hugely popular viewing parties. They're both in studio with me. And can we also give a shout out to more women's sporting success? What about Katarina Johnson-Thompson claiming a stunning heptathlon gold at the World Championships in Budapest? I mean, it's this remarkable turnaround in her career and also so inspiring. So a shout out to her and to some more stories today from you. A listener got in touch about her uncontrollable urge to shoplift. So she'll tell her story about trying to get help for her kleptomania. We'll also hear from an expert on those issues. We also have women in the world of heavy metal. So get ready for some headbanging this morning. And we'll also discuss mattress sense. That's a new term for me. It's a term that describes the process of becoming a mother and how the reality stacks up against the cultural myth of motherhood. A lot to talk about. We have a lot to talk about. But let us begin with football. It might not have been, as we're saying, the World Cup glory for England's Lionesses, but they did make history and they have inspired so many of us along the way. Woman's Hour was at a viewing party in South London held by the grassroots clubs Deptford Ravens, Lush Life and Bended Like Peckham. Here's what they got up to.
Let's hear it for the first time the Lionesses in the World Cup final!
Honestly, before kind of this tournament, I would never sit down and like watch a match. I love seeing like Chloe Kelly with her like eyelashes and her nails. Like those kind of traditional women things that are always kind of belittled a little bit or like made to be less serious. And seeing all of that and still smashing it like is so great.
The people want to shout out some score predictions.
2-0!
We've got 2-0, we've got 2-1. 3-1.
when's the last time an England team have gone to the final? When it was in black and white. So, you know, it's still something we have to be very proud of. Obviously, we wanted to go the one step further, but, you know, next time. We'll get them next time.
Yeah, we'll get them next time.
We have one more cheer for Mary Earps.
For me, it's that Lionesses are football, and they are such good role models as well in the way that they, like, interact with each other and are able to sort of have a laugh and be human about it. Considering the lack of resources they have, they've done so well, and they could do even better with more.
They're just such nice people, aren't they? And I think that that's enabled, like, everyone else that's watching them and supporting them to, like, model a new version of football culture as well. And that, like, trickles down from them all the way down to, like, the grassroots that we're involved in. And so I think that's just, like, a really beautiful thing.
If you want to get involved, just get involved. That's the best thing about women's football. Everyone can get involved. And we'll be back in 4 years.
So, some much-needed optimism there, and I'm joined now by two listeners of Women's Hour who love football, but despite growing up in different times, both experienced barriers to playing. Women, of course, were banned from playing for over 50 years, with the legacy of that ban felt for many generations after, as we've spoken about. And it makes the achievements of yesterday being in a World Cup final all the more remarkable. Many of you, no doubt, will remember Sue Wyatt. Sue was part of the England team in 1972 who failed to receive their international caps. Sue emailed us here at Women's Hour to highlight that, and the story even got mentioned in Parliament. So Sue and her teammates finally received their caps last year. So it goes to show a little the power of of Women's Hour. Sue is in studio with us. Welcome, Sue.
Hi, thank you very much.
Great to have you with us. I'm also joined by Jo Clark. Jo has been a dedicated follower of the Lionesses all her life, but trying to watch games at pubs, even in big tournaments, it had always been a challenge. So Jo and her friend set up Baller FC. So it's an inclusive space where fans from any country can come and watch women's games. And during the World Cup, they've had queues around the block, I hear, and even had to find a bigger venue for yesterday's final. Welcome, Jo.
Thanks so much. Such a pleasure to be here.
OK, how are we feeling?
Oh, obviously upset for them yesterday, as could be seen some of the photos of me with tears rolling down my face. But do you know what? They've done us proud throughout, and we can't expect anything else from them. It isn't a game where, you know, oh, right, well, they'll go on and they'll score 10 goals or whatever. Do you know what? They played their hearts out. It wasn't for them. And Spain were brilliant. Paraguelo, I mean, she was just amazing. Cut our defence in half. And, yeah, they deserved to win. And well done, Spain. But obviously, we were all in tears. We were in bits because we really did expect them to bring it home.
I know. I did see your photo in lots of the papers today. You were watching at Wembley Box Park.
Yeah.
How was it and who was with you?
Right. Well, we all decided that the 72 squad, those of us that are fit to travel, we've all been meeting up since the Women's Hour programme. We've vowed never to be apart again. We will keep in touch no matter what. So there was eight of us there at Box Park. We've all got our own special shirts on, which say, yes, we were the first 1972 Lionesses. Yeah. And we've had such a reaction from all the people there, from all the fans and people, as you say, who've never watched football before, coming up to us and saying, it's wonderful, you started it, thank you so much. It's been an absolute wonderful roller coaster of emotion. But no, it's been just been fabulous.
Roller coaster is a good word, isn't it, Jo? How was your watching party that you were hosting yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, to echo, I think, what Sue said, like, obviously disappointed with the result, but what a summer of football it's been. And for us at Baller FC, we've just so enjoyed these incredible watch parties and having so many passionate fans and a real community of fans come and enjoy it with us.
But we need to get across how raucous these events are.
Yeah, it's wild, I'd say, like very, very wild. Like there's so much passion, like, and I think, I mean, Sue can attest to this, like the barriers that so many women and girls face trying to play football, not just play actually, just follow and enjoy football.
Yes.
And so to have a space, and we're so proud of the one that we've created at Baller FC, but with our good friends at Deptford Ravens have done incredible jobs and so many other organisations also, creating safe spaces for people to come and be themselves, watch football, really enjoy it, go wild when we score. Yeah, I mean, like, not a dry T-shirt, I think, in the house with thinking with Mary Earps is saying it was as if we'd won the World Cup.
With like, Mary Earps, we need to speak about her, don't we?
We do. Oh, she is just so wonderful. She really, and such a nice person.
So you were a goalie all those years ago. So, of course, you have that connection. You've actually spent some time with her as
well. I have, yes, yeah, yeah. And obviously, she plays for Manchester United, so she's not far from me as well. So what a lovely, lovely person she is. When we went to Wembley, she shouted, Sue, you come and stand with me over here. And, you know, they're just so ordinary. And yet she's like a warrior queen, isn't she?
She is a warrior queen. Ordinary yet extraordinary at the same time.
That's right. And just such a kind, generous person as well. She really is. With the time, you see her with those fans after the matches. She spends longer than anybody out there talking to the fans, shaking young kids' hands, throwing her gloves to them. She knows that she is there. I mean, obviously, she wasn't straight as the number one goalie from the start. She sat on the sideline like I sat on the sideline. And so she knows what it's like to be on the difficult side of goalkeeping, which is often, it's almost dead men's shoes you're waiting for, you know. So she has been just wonderful, yeah.
What was it like yesterday where both of you were when she saved that penalty kick?
Oh, absolutely hysterical, yeah, yeah. We were screaming, I mean, hardly any of us could speak yesterday after the match. We were so hoarse through shouting and screaming, and particularly, obviously, after that saving that penalty. But you know what? I thought she'll have this. She'll have this. She is a great penalty saver. She's brilliant.
And let's see as well. Of course, there was a controversy that Nike hadn't created a Mary Earps kit. Let's see what happens next.
Yes, how can they not have a kit with Earps on the back? It's just unbelievable. I want one, and that's just a start. Yes.
Let's talk about you and your full kit for a second, though, Sue, because you have been on a journey over this past year. You talked about emailing Women's Hour, but it was about getting a cap. Tell our listeners what happened.
Yes, well, obviously we hadn't been given caps in 1972 when we played, and a lady did make us some little homemade ones because they used to give us things like Wedgwood dishes instead, and we said no, we want a cap, and she made us a lovely cap which I would never. So I got on to it was just before the Euros, and you were asking for people who had.
Stories
about the Euros. And I just said, do you know the 72 squad haven't had a cap? And you asked me to come on, and it went from there. And then even better, when we heard that we were going to get the caps, I asked if you could ask about my friend Jeannie Allett, who we couldn't find anywhere. And within half an hour, somebody had phoned in with her email. And she's been to every single match with us. She's come over from Holland. I mean, she played for the Netherlands as well as England, you know. I mean, it's just been a journey and a half. It really has.
It's so wonderful. And then you did receive the caps. We were talking, it was last October, right?
Yes, the USA game. Yes,
between
yes,
the US, yes, which yes, I actually yes. was at. So I'm delighted to meet you in person.
Yeah,
I saw you from a distance at that stage and could see kind of the camaraderie between the players and their families, the community. And I was struck by one of the people that we heard in the clip at that viewing party, that they... We're talking about a new version of football culture being created.
Yeah, without a doubt, I think we've certainly felt that at Ball. And I think that's something that we really want to try and promote as much as possible. You know, when we sort of thought about what Baller could be, it was really born out of not being able to find culture, women's football culture. And we would go to pubs and venues, and they weren't showing the football. They didn't think it was a priority. And so, you know, for us, ahead of the Euros last year, we got together and were like, let's take matters into our own hands and let's put the football like front and centre where it should be. But let's really celebrate the culture around women's football, which is inclusive, which is about celebrating each other. And I think that really was showed yesterday after the final whistle. Of course, we were disappointed, but we went straight into party mode to celebrate what has been an incredible summer of football. So much to be proud of for the Lionesses, but also just for women's football overall. Incredible, the World Cup that Australia and New Zealand delivered. Incredible to see newer nations getting further, like Nigeria, Morocco, Jamaica, South Africa. Like, for women's football as a whole, that's what we were celebrating yesterday.
Can I just ask, what did you think about the viewing a men's game during the World Cup, the Women's World Cup final? Just so disrespectful. I couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe it at all. Yeah. If it was a men's World Cup, they wouldn't have done that. Everything Why are they putting a Premiership match on at that time?
This is the other aspect that struck me yesterday. I was in a pub watching. There was obviously lots of England fans, but Spanish fans as well. And I thought about that of opposing sides coming into one space, which you don't always see with men's football.
No, you
and
don't
certain
at all.
Bars you can't go in if you're not the That's home right. team, for example.
And I take my grandchildren to the matches at City and United for the ladies' games, and it's a wonderful atmosphere. We all sit together, City and United fans sitting together, dads with the daughters, big families, and we're all having some banter. We shook hands after the match and all left together in a really lovely, friendly atmosphere. You can't beat that.
Do you think that will continue? As this becomes bigger, more investments, we're going to start seeing sponsorship deals, I'm sure, to the level that we probably haven't seen before.
It does worry me that the fact that money will be coming into the game so much, and will it start to divide us? I really hope it doesn't. I think the other thing is we need to nurture our own talent as well and not keep buying in talent from other countries, because how are the kids going to have a pathway into the WSL if they're bringing in all the players from abroad? I think they have to think that one through, because that's what's happened as well in the men's game.
And do you feel, though, the progress, you're looking back on the last 50 years and we're very much celebrating the success of the Lionesses, and particularly in recent years, do you feel that it is, the progress is moving as fast as it should be?
Do you know what? Yes, but only since the Euros. I think that has that's been a super boost to, and the way the team actually put that out there, that yes, we want girls being able to play football in every school, and the government actually taking that on. I think that has done more than anything.
I mean, I think it's 100 years in the making though, right? Like this,
it is.
This progress. So it's accelerating now at the rate that I think it should always have been. But you have to remember that, you know, for 50 years, like you said, we were banned and then we were discouraged from playing. And it's only really been in the last sort of 20 to 30 years that there's been any kind of interest and investment. And now, finally, now, because of that investment, we're really seeing the results on the pitch. And of course, what happens on the pitch trickles down to the grassroots level. So, yes, but it's 100 years in the making. I think that's really important to remember.
Yeah, and obviously 30 years too late,
to be fair. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a pivotal moment. We'll keep talking. Message to the Lionesses today?
Girls, you've been absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for all you've done for us.
Proud, just so, so proud.
Thank you both so much, Sue Wyatt and Joe Clark, and lots of listeners getting in touch. A magnificent achievement in its own right, but even more so when you consider how few resources and how little encouragement women and girls get from primary school playground upwards. Another, my name is Francesca, I'm 12 years old and I love playing football. I'm part of Riviera United under 13's team and captain of my school team. The Lionesses are inspiring as they demonstrate what dreams are made of. They train hard, play hard, and I'm so proud to think they represent women's football. Keep coming. 84844. As I have been mentioning, it is listener week, so we are telling your stories. And one woman wrote to us and said, I'm a middle-aged 51-year-old woman, a professional who would probably be classified as middle class. I've been hiding a terrible and shameful secret which has plagued my life for as long as I remember. It's a topic that's never discussed and it's shrouded in shame. Her topic is shoplifting. Fully aware that shoplifting is a criminal offence and not something that should be condoned, she wanted to highlight her story on this programme. My interview with Jane, not her real name, has been voiced by an actor.
I was diagnosed with kleptomania a couple of years ago. It's been something that's blighted me for the whole of my life.
Do you remember when it started?
Mm-hmm. I was about 8, from a big family, not a lot of food, so we were hungry a lot. And so I went into a shop, saw a packet of crisps right in front of me and thought, I'm having those. Took them and went out of the shop, got away with it, and then continued doing it practically every day after school on the way home. And then I got caught when I was about 8 or 9, and that was a really frightening experience.
What do you remember from that time? I'm just thinking of this little girl, if she's 8 or 9.
This is the 70s. The children weren't treated in quite the same way as they are now. So I walked out the shop, and there was a hand on my shoulder saying, you haven't paid for that. And I just said, no, I haven't. And she escorted me to the back of the shop and said, we're going to have to phone your parents. And they locked me in the back cupboard so I couldn't come out. And I remember banging on the door and screaming to let me out, but they wouldn't. I phoned my mum because obviously I gave her my number and she was not best pleased with my behaviour at all. She was quite a ferocious lady. That's what I remember. The absolute fear and the shame when she told people that there was a thief in the house.
Who did she tell?
It was my sisters.
I mean, that sounds like a traumatic memory, Jane.
Yeah, you'd think that would be the end of it, wouldn't you? But unfortunately, I suppose I just got clever at it.
I mean, it probably was different, you tell me. But why you continued to shoplift, like a 10-year-old shoplifting is quite different to a 25-year-old. Was the feeling when you did it, Jane, the same?
Yes, I'd be wrong to say I didn't get an illicit sort of thrill at doing it and getting away with it. But my overriding reason for doing it is because basically I was hungry and my friends would have nice packed lunches. I'm not trying to make excuses, but they'd have nice packed lunches and I wouldn't. And it was just one way of getting some food that was deemed acceptable by my peers, really.
But that was when you were younger. Did you try and stop?
Yeah. And I think I was quite successful at it for a while. And then my mother died when I was in my teens and it sort of picked up again then. It's been times of crisis in my life that it has picked up. But for the last 2 or 3 years, I haven't been able to stop at all.
So it's an impulse that you're not able to...
It's an impulse control disorder, yes.
But, you know, is that fear there that you'll get caught? I mean, to tell our listeners, you're now in your early 50s, you have a job, but yeah, you continue to shoplift.
I do. And my fear is that the only way it's going to stop is if I get caught, get arrested and lose my job and all the possible friendships that I've gathered over the years as well. Because I know this is something that is obviously wrong, is obviously illegal, but I can't see any way out of it. I would understand why people are so horrified by it.
Have you tried to speak to anyone? I mean, would you even be able to speak to your employer about this?
Oh my gosh, no. I'd be out of a job straight away. I'm a secondary school teacher, have been for a number of years and fairly well respected within the profession.
And when do you think now you shoplift? You alluded there that in times of stress, you seem to turn to it. That what it is at the moment, or you tell me?
I know that when the cost of living crisis began, trying to find food that was actually enjoyable got more and more complicated. And also my job, particularly at the moment, is pretty stressful. I mean, education is in a bit of a state at the moment and teachers bear the brunt of it. So I do feel that has got a lot to do with it. The actual taking of something gives you a psychological boost, for want of a better word. And for that short amount of time, you actually feel good. But then that's taken away pretty much immediately by shame and fear of being caught. The shame that you feel when you've done it is just horrendous.
What about that shame? Let's talk about that a little bit as well, because you've had two recent incidences as well that maybe illustrate as well your experience for our listeners.
So the first instance, I took a bottle of Coke and I'd taken some other stuff because I was making a meal that night for some people. And as I walked out of the shop, the security guard said, you haven't paid for those items. And he was a big guy. And I said, no, I haven't. I said, what's going to happen now? And he says, I want you to pay for the items. I said, thank you. That's really kind. So he walked me over to the till and then said, we won't take it any further, but please don't come back again. His kindness actually made it worse in a way, because I thought, I've just done something that's hideous. So I came away feeling shame for nicking the stuff in the first place, and then almost sorry for the guy that he's having to confront people like this. And I got home and I did bawl my eyes out after that. And I've never been to that shop since. And that was a couple of years ago now. Just walking home, feeling that everyone's looking at you, everyone knows that you're not who you say you are. And then actually when you get home, if you have got away with it, not even being able to eat or prepare some of the stuff that you've brought because the guilt is so much.
And the second incident?
The second one was worse. I just had this urge to take things off the shelves and put it in my bag. it was so obvious I was doing it. I went to the pet area to get dog food and I was literally stuffing it in my bag. I knew I wasn't going to get away with it. I just couldn't stop myself. And I walked to the counter, paid for some of the stuff that I got. I went out of the shop, hand on the shoulder, could you come with me? We know you haven't paid for that stuff. Yes, of course. Follow the lady through the shop past all the tills. You're escorted to the back room, which terrified me. I knew they wouldn't lock me in, but I don't like being locked in places. They took my address. The store detective was lovely. The manager wasn't quite so, obviously. They decided they wouldn't call the police. Told me I was banned from the shop and I'd receive a letter saying that I'm banned. And then eventually escorted me out of the shop past the tills where I'd previously just bought some stuff from the lady. Oh, it was so utterly humiliating. And all the time I'm just apologising. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. It was awful. Really, really bad. And I think I took the next day off work because I was still so shaken by it.
And from those incidences, was there a turning point at all? Or
Yeah. That was the turning point to get help from the GP.
Had you spoken about this before with them?
No, never.
What happened there?
He put me in a list for the NHS talking therapies, but the list was very, very long. So I asked for a referral to a psychiatrist and I'd pay for it myself, which is what I did. And then the psychiatrist, along with little other diagnoses that go along with it, said I had impulsive control disorder, kleptomania specifically, and very, very difficult to treat, apparently. And that took 3 sessions, actually, to get a diagnosis. And then they recommend a therapist to do the work with you, by which time the NHS had said, right, we've got a space. So I went through the NHS for that one. Had 3 sessions, really, really good. And then the therapist left. They gave you another therapist. That therapist left. And they gave me another therapist. And each time you get a new therapist, you have to relive everything all over again, right from birth up to where you are now. And I just thought, I can't do it. I'm not doing it again. So that was it. I just left and cancelled everything. I tried to cope with it on my own.
And how's that going?
Not particularly well, to be honest. I try. Actually, summer holidays help because during a school day, I stop at the shops and get my lunch every day. I'm not doing that. So if I don't leave the house, it's not a problem. But I don't want to become a hermit.
You know, just as I was preparing to speak to you, I saw a couple of headlines. One was shoplifters could be handed prison sentences under revisions to the crime bill. And then the other was jailing shoplifters will not address root causes. That was according to a senior Tory. I mean, what do you think about that?
That is absolutely terrifying, to be honest, because when I spoke to one psychologist, our relationship broke down because she said, if you tell me that you're going to continue, I'll have to report you. That's utterly terrifying. But I do know you don't get a prison sentence the first time you do it. So I think there's a root cause why people do it. Of course, there's a core of people that do it because they say, bugger to the system. This is what I deserve. This is what I want. And then you've got the people like myself who desperately do not want to do it, but have got a massive compulsion. I think it's a bit of a public health issue, but it's got 2 sides to it.
Do you want people that don't shoplift to try and understand you?
Yes, I would like that. I did try to broach the subject with one friend, not telling her it was me we were talking about. And she was horrified that people would do that, that people would shoplift. And I'm looking at her thinking, but I've been your friend for years. This is me. I'm trying to open up to you. But the risks are too high.
And what about those, perhaps like your friend that you mentioned, they hear of shoplifting and they're like, this is such a drain on the economy. It affects people's lives. This makes products more expensive because the amount of shoplifting that does go on. If they're not feeling that sympathetic towards you, what would you say?
I totally agree with them. It is a drain on the economy, increased food prices, but none of that is enough for someone who's got an impulse control disorder to stop.
And for those that say you have to get help, it's up to you to take control of that aspect?
Well, yeah, I tried and I completely, completely agree. I wouldn't have phoned up sitting here telling you all this and not had tried to make some sort of resolution.
a listener that we are calling Jane, not her real name, who got in touch with the programme. Well, I want to speak next to Dr. Heather Sekira, consultant, psychologist and member of the British Psychological Society, who has treated people with kleptomania. Welcome, Dr. Heather. I mean, you're hearing some of the story that Jane was telling us there. How common is this?
We really don't know how common it is because we haven't done enough research on it. But the stats at the moment suggest it's about 0.3% of the population, with about three times more women diagnosed with it than men.
We could hear also Jane's struggles there, trying to get it under control. How do you understand the underlying reasons for it?
It's complicated, and certainly no one size fits all here. But what people typically describe, similar to Jane, is a childhood background of resource scarcity, frequently poverty, or events that they've experienced as a child where they feel powerless, or trauma events such as childhood sexual abuse. Eating disorders is also very common in people's childhoods.
It was interesting. Food did come up a lot in our conversation related to the aspects or the particular products that she took. But this is different, right, to another person who is going in to shoplift for financial gain.
Oh, absolutely. So you can think of this a bit more like being addicted to stealing. Very different from shoplifting. Perhaps an example works here. So somebody who steals perfumes to sell on eBay, then that's clearly something for personal gain. Somebody's getting something out of it. But if a different person steals those same perfumes and feels this kind of instinctive urge to steal, can't think of anything else until they do it, and then it builds up, they steal the perfume, they may experience a brief sense of thrill or excitement like Jane did, and then it quickly fades into this huge shame or guilt. And frequently people don't use the items that they've stolen. They may put them in a drawer where they've got 100 other items exactly the same. I've met people who've left them on buses or given the items away, or sometimes they even take them back to the shop to try and get rid of that guilt.
Huh. So it's really all about that impulse or urge that they're unable to control. What about with Jane, coming back to the food again? How do you understand that?
Well, Jane's describing of lack of resources in the past. So she said she came from a very large family where she didn't have enough money. She envied other children's lunch boxes. And so again, she's describing that scarcity mindset that's often there in people with kleptomania. Now, Jane's a teacher now. She can clearly afford crisps or all the food she wants. But nevertheless, that scarcity mindset is still there for her in part of her brain, even though the healthy part of her brain knows she can afford it. But it's as though part of her has got stuck with that resource scarcity mindset. And also, the pattern of resolving her difficulties, those really uncomfortable feelings through stealing and getting that thrill, is still very much there. And that seems to be what's driving it. And of course, then she feels the shame and the guilt. She feels awful again. And that drives the behaviour further because she's trying to get rid of those really uncomfortable feelings.
And she has sought out help, but it hasn't worked for her so far. She said there was one psychologist who refused to work with her if she continued to shoplift. So she's stuck in that aspect as well. I mean, what would you be advising her to do?
That's really hard, yeah, absolutely. There are therapists out there who do understand, who do feel compassion, who would be able to help her. So I'd really urge her to try again, to reach out. CBT is the therapy of choice here. CBT helps give us the tools to regain control over these impulses.
So that is cognitive behavioural therapy that
absolutely
can be talking and trying to get to the root of issues?
Yes. Well, first of all, it helps us recognize the triggers and the emotions that underlie a stealing behavior in the here and now. Then it helps us understand why we have these triggers and emotions. And then it gives us the skills to manage the impulses and modify the behavior or put different behaviors in there in place. Other ways of dealing with really uncomfortable emotions in a way that doesn't have the negative consequences that Jane's describing.
And is there much success?
in this area?
It's hard to say because we really haven't done the research on it. So I think if people get the right therapist, somebody that really understands them, somebody who's compassionate, certainly not a person who's condemning in any way like that, but it's through that combination of examining your thinking and then modifying the behavior over time that you really build up that foundation for long-term recovery.
And what about the original catalyst for Jane to get in touch with us, that she felt she couldn't speak to anybody about this? Because there is often shame with addictions, as we know. But we are getting better at speaking about perhaps alcoholism or gambling, for example. But I don't think I've heard it spoken about so much when it comes to something like this.
No, most people who have this feel huge, huge amounts of shame, and there's very little understanding about it in the community. Yeah. So the more we can talk about it, and the more we can help people understand that this isn't something people choose to do. Again, it's like being addicted to stealing, like other addictions. And it's just a way of people trying to manage really uncomfortable behaviors. So if we can get people understanding it more, they can come forward and get help and, you know, learn that there is a recovery out there for them.
Dr. Heather Sakira, thank you so much, consultant psychologist and member of the British Psychological Society. Now, do remember, and thanks to Jane, I should say, not her real name, for sending in that idea. Remember, we do have a whole week ahead of your stories, your ideas, your suggestions. And if there's something you feel we've missed, do let us know. Maybe it's a powerful personal story. Maybe it's an unusual hobby. Something you've seen in the headlines that you'd like us to discuss. This is your opportunity to get it onto Woman's Hour. Text us 84844 or indeed social media at BBC Woman's Hour or email us through our website. I'm asking you this morning about the lionesses, how it has impacted you, this roller coaster of a ride that we've been on to you. What do they mean to you now after that final yesterday? You have a moment to reflect. Here's one. Cried with joy at the lionesses' achievement. Didn't matter that they were defeated at the final. Their achievement is unmatched. So good to see women's physical bodies being celebrated for strength and skill as opposed to their sexuality. Also great to see all the little wannabe lionesses, all the cubs, on the high street in their England kits. 84844 if you'd like to get in touch. Okay, our next listener, Laura, has told us that despite our coverage of varied music genres, we've less regularly covered one in particular. Can you guess? Heavy metal. And as a byproduct, women's important place within the heavy metal scene. We have not covered either, says Laura. So today is Metal Day. Well, it might surprise you to know that heavy metal has over 125 subgenres. My next guest has made it her mission to understand them and where they come from. In a moment, I'll be speaking to the anthropologist Lindsay Bishop. For her PhD, Lindsay conducted 10 years of fieldwork, embedding herself in heavy metal culture, touring with bands and also attending gigs. So we're going to hear from Lindsay. And I'm also joined by Becky Baldwin, a bassist from Birmingham. She plays in the Midlands-based band Fury and has toured with Mercyful Fate, and that's a group that's influenced the likes of Metallica. Brilliant to have you with us, Becky and Lindsay. Becky, where did it start for you?
In terms of like listening to heavy
loving
metal?
Loving it, yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, I was always a little bit, I'd never really found much of a community when I was a child, and like my friendship groups were quite like, they kept moving, you know, and but I was kind of interested in darker themes. I became more interested in like horror films and this kind of thing, like the Goosebumps books and things like this. And so when I then came across heavy metal from getting like Sky TV and having like music channels on there, and was kind of exposed to Kerrang and Scuzz and those channels that played alternative music, and also getting the internet around the same time, this was like the early 2000s, it really opened my eyes to different kinds of music. And there is where I found my community of friends. And it just really, the music spoke to me a lot more.
And what about you, Lindsay? Where did your love begin and your in-depth research?
That's two different dates.
Yeah, I come from a slightly older generation than Becky. So for me, it was vinyl album covers that really sort of drew me in. My mum's record collection and seeing like Black Sabbath and like Becky was saying, it's like that, the darkness really drew me. I always preferred like the evil queens in Disney. And, you know, it's it was a rock and roll kind of music, but I was always craving something heavier and heavier. And that's like when I became a teenager and I had a bit more autonomy about what I was listening to and was looking at like the front cover of Kerrang. And then, you know, it's just like, the free CDs, that was the thing that got me as well. That was my only access because we didn't have the internet and we didn't have MTV. And so, it was just looking for something like the rock wasn't quite doing it. And it was just to like, it was almost like seeking out a drug to get as heavy as possible. As dark
okay.
as possible.
Well, let's play a little bit of Becky's stuff. Now here's a blast of Rock Lives in My Soul by Becky's band Fury. Becky, that is vocalist Kim Jennett there. Tell us a little bit more about this song that is very much female focused.
So the song, it was just an idea that we wanted to collaborate with someone else in the music industry. And we were looking at some other bands and who to work with. And like Kim was doing some great stuff. And we thought, OK, it'd be great to work with a female musician as the other vocalist. And then we were thinking about duets and how do duets work in a metal context, because you know, so often they're like love songs, and we were like, what about something that's like angry and like they're kind of shouting at each other about stuff, you know, kind of like I guess Meatloaf like have done that kind of thing back in the day. But we were like, well, what would they talk about? And we thought, well, let's talk about sexism in the music industry in general. And then actually our kind of new co-vocalist, Naya, she penned most of the lyrics for that from her own experiences. And in the music video, before we, when we were getting together the music video, we asked women just in our circles in the music industry if they'd experienced any sexism during their work. And, you know, ask them to share their experiences. And we use some of the quotes from what they said and put them in the video to just make it a little bit more striking and just show like this is real. This happens. This is what women working in the music industry are facing every day.
So, for example, one of the lines that got me there is, I'm not here to be your girlfriend. Is that something that comes up that people are expecting the girl to be the girlfriend or the woman that's around?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Like there's been so many times at venues where I'm just not spoken to, like the men in the band will be spoken to and I'll be kind of ignored and assumed to be, you know, an extra, like a groupie or like just not part of the band. And there have been times where I've applied to a band is advertising for a bass player. And I'll respond to it and they'll say, we all have wives and girlfriends. We don't want you to play bass for us. And I was like, that's not what I was asking for. And like, you know, I would have a boyfriend too. And like, I was just asking if you need a bass player. And I'm just saying that I am one. And I don't know, like, yeah, people don't really, they just feel very surprised, I suppose, when they see that there's women in the industry, and it just makes it harder for us to establish ourselves.
And Lindsay, what did you find? Because you were looking into heavy metal for 10 years. What's it like when it comes to inclusivity?
Well, I think what Becky was talking about is really important distinction to make, is like it's the industry versus the everyday lives of the majority, the millions of people who are listening to heavy metal are not reflective of each other. I think in the industry, certainly. So there's the thing to think about with heavy metal is that it's not its own culture. There's no original kind of island of heavy metal. Uh-huh. And then it's spread out here. So every heavy metal community in all over the world is coming on top of a sort of parent culture, a mainstream culture, if you like. And while that can allow some really interesting things like new musical instruments and the evolution of different metal subgenres, that also means it's vulnerable to some of the problems of that, you know, that community. And quite frankly, it's just a global issue. It's harder to be a woman, and therefore, I think that's where a lot of the sexism comes from. And my challenge has been, just is it coming from heavy metal, is it part of the culture? Is this sort of gender bias part of the culture, or is it something that's bled through?
I understand, coming from society into that music or that arena, so to speak. But let me, Becky, for a moment, also mention to my listeners that you did tour, I mentioned it briefly, an iconic band, Mercyful Fate. And that was, they were specifically looking for a female bass player.
I think at first they weren't really. They were just looking at bass players, and but their management brought forward a list, and they weren't sure about the bass players on that list, but they did notice it was all men, and then they were like, "Well, let's expand our search." Or, I mean, has the management only given me male bass players for a reason? And they, I don't know, they just thought they'd expand the pool and make a point of looking at female bass players. And that's where I was found by Hank Sherman, who's a guitarist, who said, actually, I've seen this girl playing bass videos online, and she likes that kind of classic heavy metal. So I think that would be a really good thing to do. And yeah, they agreed to it.
And how was it?
It was fantastic. Yeah, it was insane. I've never, you know, played shows of that standard. Like, it was between 2,000 and 5,000 capacity venues every night, and you know, it was a big step up for me, and I'd never expected to play with a legendary band, like a band that I was listening to since I was a teenager. And I don't know, they're a band that influenced my favorite band, Metallica. So yeah, it was just crazy. And you know, meeting all the people there, and everyone was so kind to me, and it was great, because it was something I was very nervous about, because I've had these experiences, I guess, at the kind of more local level and the independent level of touring. I thought, like, perhaps is it going to get worse, or is it going to be actually easier dealing with professionals in a kind of higher up place of the industry? But actually, you know, everyone was very kind. There were still a few things that like would come up. But I don't know, you know, like just when you just walk into a room and someone says, "Oh, who's this? Oh, what's your name, love?" And you're just like, "Oh my God, like, just treat me like a band member." Yeah.
Okay, you mentioned Metallica. Is that, for listeners that aren't heavy metal fans, is that who you would point them towards?
Yes, I think, you know, it's a very great kind of gateway band to get into heavy metal. And then you can kind of, they've got a lot of different eras as well. So they've got heavier stuff and softer stuff. So I think, yeah, that's a great place to start.
Becky Baldwin, thank you so much. Lindsay, your suggestion for our listeners that haven't listened to heavy metal?
I think there's so many to start with. I mean, Black Sabbath are classic, but I think given that our emphasis on women, I would have to suggest like My Ruin or Ginger are doing some really interesting things just now if you're looking for more women in metal.
Lindsay Bishop, thank you so much. And thanks also to our listener, Laura, who suggested that particular topic. Now, our next item was chosen by listener Sue Stewart, who got in touch with Woman's Hour to tell us about the impact on her of the book Matrescence by the science and nature writer Lucy Jones. Now, matrescence is the time during pregnancy, childbirth and early motherhood when women undergo far-reaching changes, which Lucy argues are more profound, wild and long-lasting than we've ever been led to believe. Sue is with us, as is Lucy. Welcome to you both. What about that word, Lucy? Matrescence. I'm pronouncing it correctly? How would you say it?
I don't think that's the right way. I tend to say matrescence.
Matrescence,
because then it, you can link it kind of with adolescence.
Oh, I like that.
Which is more familiar.
So what do you... I was reading about it being like the birth of a mother.
Right. So matrescence is a word that was first coined by the anthropologist Dana Raphael in the 70s, so quite a long time ago, but it's coming into kind of common parlance and as an emerging concept in the last really 5 or 10 years. I discovered it when I was, my first child was about 9 months old, and I had a sense that something pretty major was kind of happening to me. My brain felt different, my mind, of course, my body, my relationships, my sense of self. And at the time, I was kind of ashamed by how big and seismic and drastic I experienced this transition. But then I read this word matrescence, and it was the first time my shoulders kind of dropped. And it describes, as you say, this process of becoming a mother. And it just normalized for me the kind of heft of the experience. And I wanted to make sense of why that the experience of matrescence is so big for women, but also so kind of underwritten.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that, you know, feminism has won so many rights and ways of being in the world for women, but care working and caregiving and the maternal experience has been quite disavowed and neglected. And I mean, if you look at Western culture and philosophy, there's a spectacular disavowal of the maternal in the kind of the very foundations of our thinking and being in our culture. But I think and I hope that part of the fifth wave of feminism might incorporate caregiving and care work and maternal health and well-being. One of the reasons why I wanted to write this book was because I looked around me and I saw so many new mothers often at breaking point, really struggling. Matrescence is a powerful experience, but it's also a vulnerable experience. And I think only now are we starting to hear more stories about what that's like and what we need to support women in their matrescence.
Let me bring in Sue. Sue, why did this book touch you so much, do you think? What was it that resonated with you?
Because, as Lucy says, so little is spoken about in a really deep way about what becoming a mother is about. And she was the draw card for me at the Wealden Literary Festival.
Maternal ambivalence, that chapter really grabbed me. Let me get Lucy first too. How would you explain maternal ambivalence?
Well, I think it's so interesting, isn't it, that we have the phrase maternal ambivalence, because, of course, ambivalence is threaded through all of our relationships in terms of mixed feelings. Your life is a roller coaster and you know, it's complex emotionally. Now, how could this most intensive of human relationships not include some, you know, mixed feelings?
And a push-pull, I think.
Push-pull, exactly. And, you know, obviously there's so much joy in having a child, but there's a lot of stress, there's lots of worry, a lot of fear. You might be physically recovering from childbirth and pregnancy. There's the agony and the ecstasy. And I guess maternal ambivalence describes that. But I think what is not good is that these feelings are outlawed in some ways. You know, we're not always allowed to speak of them. And that can lead to kind of feelings of shame and women feeling that they can't talk about their experience, that there might be something wrong with them for finding aspects of motherhood difficult.
And you had your children, Sue, 50 years ago, right? I think you're due to become a grandmother perhaps soon.
Not 50 years ago, 37 years ago.
Oh, sorry, forgive me. Maybe your child, I'm probably doing my maths wrong. But did you feel that maternal ambivalence? I mean, was part of that was speaking to you?
Oh, definitely. And it was quite frightening, actually, to be so sort of cross at this little individual and at society and at things in general, yet and not knowing actually how to make anything better maybe for the child, but yet to have such deep love.
Yes.
Deep, deep love.
So coming back to that as well, that maternal ambivalence, that comes, no doubt, after the woman has gone through these profound physical changes, obviously, but also societal, mental. You also talk about the brain and what happens in those early years.
Right. So when I had my first child, I had this real sense that my brain had changed. It felt very different. And at the same time, there's been this incredible flourishing of the science of motherhood and particularly neuroscience around the maternal brain and the parental brain. And what we are discovering is that pregnancy renders significant, consistent, pronounced changes in the brain. It could be seen as a kind of fine tuning of synaptic connections to enable the mother to do what she needs to do, care for the child. However, we also know now that the father's brain changes anatomically as well. And of course, caregiver brains will change too. We evolved in caregiving networks. The way we live now is very kind of historically unique. You know, children will have been raised by lots of different people, so it makes sense that we are all born with the neural circuitry in order to caregive. But the neuroscience of the brain, I think, really deepened my understanding that this was a seismic change, which also involves plasticity of the brain, which can make it a more vulnerable transition and life stage for the woman.
So the information is out there, and you did lots of really interesting scientific experiments on yourself as well, whether it was about breast milk or other aspects of becoming a mother. But why do you think then that it's not common knowledge? You also, for example, put out there, you know, the pain during childbirth and what that's for and how much you actually know about it before you go through it yourself. Why do you think there's that withholding, particularly like among women, right? Because we've all got sisters, mothers, daughters, friends.
Yes, I think my experience was that what I saw depicted culturally about motherhood didn't match up in any way to my actual experience. What I saw was this kind of maternal ideal, very sentimentalised, the kind of natural, in scare quotes, mother who's kind of pastel-hued and always happy and so on. Whereas my experience of it was it was very wild and almost like adolescence, quite kind of disturbing. But I think that there are these oppressive maternal ideals culturally which serve to kind of silence and invisibilise care work. You know, there's a lot of taboo. There's taboos around the maternal body and the experience of childbirth, of breastfeeding. And also, I think there is a fundamental philosophical disavowal of our vulnerability in our culture. You know, we've had to, as women, you know, we've been allowed into a male world. And part of that has been to kind of disavow our reproductive capacities and so on. However, we are vulnerable. Infants are vulnerable. New mothers are vulnerable. And actually, you know, if you look at the way society treats mothers, you wonder, you know, how have we got to this point where 20% of women are facing mental illness in the first years of motherhood? How have we built a society where we don't value caregivers? Why is care so invisible? I would say that the economic piece is really important there. You know, care work is not part of GDP. Nursery workers living in poverty. We do not value care in our society, and that's a problem.
Lucy Jones, Mattresons. Matrescence is the way to say it. Matrescence. Thank you so much. And thanks to Sue Stewart for bringing it to us here on Woman's Hour as well. Coming up on day two of Listener Week, a listener, Liz Cookman, asked us to feature the women involved in the fighting in Ukraine. There are around 16,000 of the soldiers fighting out there are female, 5,000 on the front line. We'll talk about them. I will see you tomorrow. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
From BBC Radio 4, morning. A new fiction podcast.
I want you to hold something for me.
Hold something.
A holiday in Dubai.
The missing Korean telecommunications tycoon was found dead this morning.
Takes a deadly turn.
A guy you've never seen before offers you 10 grand to look after an envelope, and you take it.
Tell nobody, not even your girlfriend, okay?
There's something I need to tell you.
It'll save a lot of lives if you help us.
This is all a terrible mistake. We just want to go home. We don't want to...
Shut up!
Available now on BBC Sounds.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So, how do we get AI right?
Well, we need the right volume of data, the software to train it, and massive compute power, or...
Another one bites the dust. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat?
But with HPE GreenLake, we get access to supercomputing to power AI at the scale we need, helping generate better insights.
All right.
Nice teamwork, guys.
Search HPE GreenLake.